Welcome to the podcast, a weekly tour of sports and pop culture. It's the beginning of April 2017. We're heading toward that 1 year anniversary on the show. And today, we have a special guest with us, Josh Eberle, Hoop Magazine, NBA. Great personality on Twitter. Welcome aboard, Josh.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to make my first appearance on the Bobcast.
Yeah, it's a good time. Everyone here has a good time, so hopefully you will too. And I have something special planned for you right off the gate. We're going to do a very special edition of NBA 10 questions off the shoot right here, because I think there's a lot of important questions surrounding the NBA right now. Some interesting stuff going on. But first, let me introduce myself to people listening for the first time. I'm Bobby Manning. This is the Bobcast, a weekly tour of sports and pop culture, where we tell stories of people going from aspiration to accomplishment. The best thing you can do to support the show, you don't have to give me money, you don't have to do any of that. All I'm going to ask you to do, one favor, is give us a subscribe on iTunes. clnsradio.com/Bobcast. iTunes is where you can find our iTunes page. It's the best place to find all the episodes of the show. And it's the easiest place to listen to any episodes you want to. They're all right there. They're all right in front of you. So that's what you're going to want to do on that front. Other Twitter accounts important for you, @RealBobManning. That's where you can find me. Our guest today, Josh Eberle, is just Josh Eberle, E-B-E-R-L-E-Y. And the show page is @TheBobcastShow. And, of course, all the great CLNS Radio content you need is over at CLNS Radio, CLNS Fans on Facebook. So let's get started, Josh. Interesting today. It was wicked funny. So I was just sitting in the lobby of my dorm building this morning, and this is going to bring us right to question one as we kick off our 10 questions right here. We're going to go through these rapid fire. I brought 10 questions to the table right for you. I didn't show them to you, so you're going to have to do some quick thinking right here. First one is coming right from today. This morning I was sitting in the lobby of my dorm, and my friend walks right by me, and we're just watching the Celtics game. It just popped into my head. I just ask people this randomly all the time. I'm just fooling around with my friends. So I turn to this guy. I'm like, who's better, Jordan or LeBron? And all of a sudden he answers, and there's a ping pong tournament going on in the lobby. I don't know why, but there was. And all of a sudden, someone from across the room shouts out back to his answer. And then all of a sudden, 20 people in the lobby are shouting out loud while there's a ping pong tournament going on about Jordan versus LeBron. So I'm not going to ask you Jordan versus LeBron. What I want to ask you right off the bat here is it fair to compare players across generations, like Jordan in the 90s and LeBron in the 2010s now, or even going back to a guy like Wilt and comparing him to, say, Anthony Davis nowadays? Can you do that? Do you think that's fair?
Yeah. You know what? I don't even care if this is sidestepping the question. Life's not fair. I don't really care if it's fair or not fair. I'm not a big fan of when people chime in on a conversation. They're like, just appreciate greatness, or just let them both be special, or whatever it is. Like, no, this is sports. There's a winner. There's a loser. It's always about comparisons. It's part of what keeps the fans interested. So I guess I would say it's fair, but I don't think really whether it's fair or not fair really even factors in. It's always going to be part of this. It's always going to be part of sports culture to compare guys. I would say, like, it's definitely important to be mindful of the changes to the game, the changes in the era, and try and include that when you're having these comparisons and these conversations. But it's fun. It's sports. That's what we're doing. That's what we're all talking about before Twitter. It was forums before forums. It was the bar or whatever. I mean, it's going to happen. It's always happened.
Number two, the rookies stink this year. I mean, I'm not going to say they stink. That was strong. But the rookies this year aren't as good as they've – I mean, we've been spoiled with good rookies. Karl Anthony Towns, the likes of him. There's usually at least one guy who blows everybody's mind their rookie year. And there's a few guys emerging this year. Jamal Murray's been nice. Brogdon kicked my Celtics asses the other day. And, you know, we can go down the list of some good Jaylen Brown moments. But overall, the stats lean towards this being one of the worst rookie classes we've seen. So twofold, do you think this class wasn't good? Or do you think they're going to be good down the line, but for some reason or another, they're not good this year? And why do you think that's so, that there hasn't been really one guy to step out among them?
I think Super Dario stood up enough to get recognition. Like, I think he'll win Rookie of the Year. obviously Embiid before he got hurt. But yeah, no, I don't think this rookie class is very special. I don't think this was a great class of rookies. I think pretty much everybody who I consider credible when it comes to draft NBA comparisons was telling everyone that this was not a draft that was going to dazzle. This was not a draft of future superstars. It was a draft of a lot of good players, future good contributors in the NBA. But this is not one of those drafts where instant all-stars are born and you're looking at these guys like, wow, they might be able to carry the team. You're looking at these guys, and as you said with Jaylen Brown, there's some good moments, and you can see them being contributors in the future, and there's nothing wrong with that. However, yeah, this is not a draft class that just sparkled from the start.
Trace, and this goes hand-in-hand with the rookie conversation, is the D-League. I talk about the D-League a lot on this show, and I'm sure you've seen at least a little bit of D-League action over the years. You've seen it develop, come to be better than it is when it first started, of course. But do you think the D-League as it is right now is a success? And if it's not, what kind of things do you think the NBA could do to make it a better minor league system for the sport?
Yeah, I got to say, honestly, I'm not a huge D-League expert. I actually trust Chris Reichert with most of my D-League coverage. You see the odd game, and I'm really excited to like see guys come up, and the showcase is good. And I mean, there's some good things that have happened with the D-League. I think it's heading in the right direction. Being from Canada, you see how the pros use the underling systems to really farm their guys, expand their program through different leagues, and I think the D-League is getting there with the affiliates growing, with more and more players getting called up. I would consider it a success, but not a finished product.
Number four, New York Hoops. Then this was one that came from Twitter. Someone tweeted at us. I'd like to give them credit if we can. At PAARUSSS. I don't know how to say that, so I'm not even going to try. But he mentioned the Knicks, so I'm going to bring this to a broader term. The Knicks stink right now. We all know that. We all saw it on national TV against the Celtics. We've seen it all year long, how bad the Knicks are. And the Nets, that doesn't even need to be stated. I mean, they have no draft picks forever. They're at the bottom of the league. They're in as bad of a situation as you can get. That's the center of the basketball world, really, right there. Or at least it was in the past. New York, the Knicks, the Nets, those are huge franchises in the NBA, and they look like they're going nowhere fast. How much do you think it hurts the NBA that two marquee franchises, and even the Lakers for that matter, how much do you think it hurts the league that marquee franchises like that are in such bad situations right now, whether it comes to ownership or the personnel they have on the court or just their records at this point?
I don't think it hurts at all. I think that's one of the biggest lies, recurring lies in the NBA and in the NBA community. This is a season that I think most thought heading in that we knew we were going to see Cleveland Golden State in the final. The NBA doesn't have parity. The drum was getting banged as hard as it possibly could. The Lakers suck, the Knicks suck, the Nets suck. And you know what? The NBA is still humming. The ratings are still great. They found other things to talk about, whether it's, you know, Isaiah Thomas's year, Westbrook's triple doubles. I mean, it's played out for me. I don't think that's a great argument at all. I know that the Knicks have a great fan base. I know the Lakers have a great fan base. But the big thing about huge markets like that, they are going to swim no matter what.
Yep.
I think you're actually better to have big markets like that suck than little markets, because the teams, the smaller teams that have fickler fans and don't have as wide of the fan bases, they're the ones that are going to struggle. Lakers and Knicks are going to get turnout fans no matter what. I think that's been a big fib that we've all kind of held on to for a little bit too long.
Going off that, the Spurs, I mean, they're the prime example of a small market team that came up and has had success at the highest level with those big markets. If, say, like a market like Milwaukee or another small market came up and had that kind of success, do you think that would be a good thing for the league as well? Because, I mean, for some reason or another, the Spurs haven't done the best in the NBA Finals when it comes to ratings. Do you think that has more to do with their style or the market? Do you think a small market like Milwaukee, say, because they have a lot of good young talent right now, if they were able to make a Finals run in the near future, do you think that's something fans would rally around?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. Obviously, I think the league would always rather have a bigger city with the bigger fan base going deep, because obviously it's not as hard to sell. However, I think part of what happened with the Spurs, it was a little bit their style, but it was a little bit their superstar. I mean, Tim Duncan was not a guy who grabbed the mic after a game and yelled, "Anything is possible," or, you know, "Are you ready?" or whatever. I mean, they just didn't seize the attention like other superstars have, and basketball is a superstar league. And that's not a knock on the Spurs or anything they do. If the Bucks become the next Spurs and have a 20-year run of greatness, 50 wins every year, the equivalent win percentage, I mean, people will take notice. You can't ignore that kind of result.
Yep, and luckily for the league, the Spurs have a very dynamic personality coming up now, leading that team in Kawhi Leonard, of course. So, number five, Derrick Rose. This week we learned fourth major knee injury. He's done for the season, maybe done for his career at this point. Is he the greatest injury tragedy in NBA history, or is there another guy you think of when it comes to, man, he could have been one of the greatest ever if it wasn't for all those injuries?
I think the old heads will always say Bill Walton. Like, the old heads will always talk about Bill Walton and how he was, you know, challenging Kareem and how he, you know, won his MVP and won his championship. And even when he was a shade of himself, was a contributor in Boston. And I think there's always going to be a case there. Rose is definitely in that conversation now. There's other guys, Brandon Roy, Penny Hardaway come to mind. It's a crappy part of this game. Injuries suck. Even a guy like Derrick Rose, who I'm not a huge fan of, you can't feel bad. Just wonder what if for his whole career, because he has just been so damn unlucky.
Number six, and this is another favorite topic of mine on the show, DeMarcus Cousins. I've had my fair share of DeMarcus Cousins fights on the show. Those were all, of course, before he got traded. Now he's been on the Pelicans. Wasn't the smoothest start for them, but over the last 2 or 3 weeks or so, they've been awesome. I mean, every time those two guys are on the court together, Davis and him, they're combining for about 60 points. They're not going to make the playoffs this year, but they're definitely going to be a team to look for next year when they all come back together, maybe with some other additions. So with what you've seen from DeMarcus Cousins so far in his career, he's one of the most interesting characters we've ever seen in the NBA, because the numbers put him among the greatest ever, but the results have a lot of people questioning him. Of course, I've butted heads with a lot of people in Celtics land about whether he'd be a piece that would fit with the team. The Celtics, of course, didn't agree. They want nothing to do with him ever. Could you see him being part of a winning team in the future? Does his attitude just get too much in the way of the results that he produces with his numbers?
I think he can still be part of a winning team. You know, the example that's coming to my mind is Cleveland, when they were struggling early when LeBron James came back, and there was the talks about culture and how you don't win, or you know, you don't lose as many games as they did over 4 years, and then just walk into a locker room, no matter how great your talent is, and turn that around in a couple weeks. And I think we've seen that a little bit. The Pelicans are getting better. I think they, like you said, they'll be more interesting next year. I think Boogie has a lot to give. I think he's a very talented player. I think he could be part of a winner, but he has been in a losing, miserable culture, and it's just going to get uglier as things leak over the next few years, and more will come. But, I mean, it's an entire organization. I mean, there's been nothing positive say about the Sacramento Kings for probably a decade now, and it's hard to hold that against him on a whole. And he owns some of his own problems. He owns his own temper and his tantrums and some of the ways that he composed himself while he was there. And I get that. But I just think I would like a full year to see this guy somewhere else before I say his personality is going to override that the tremendous amount of talent that he has.
Let's talk about the Celtics for a short second. You know me, I'm the ultimate defender of these Celtics, at least, because I really believe there's something special. I really believe this team's going to prove a lot of people wrong this year when the playoffs comes, push comes to shove. So as I'm sure you've seen, I get into it on Twitter. I get into some intense fights with a lot of people when it comes to ripping the Celtics. This was definitely just trolling to the max, but someone came on my feed the other day and said that these Celtics, not the worst one seed ever, someone came in my mentions and called them the worst playoff team ever, which, you know, my head was ready for a meltdown. And I didn't respond because I knew he was just trying to lure me into something, but that's where we're at with the Celtics right now, at least when it comes to social media. I've had my issues with the way the national media is covering the Celtics with just such a lick of skepticism. But that's just kind of picking and choosing certain guys at that level. But, you know, from an outsider's perspective, someone who's not constantly immersed in the Celtics, why do you think there's such pessimism with the Celtics? I mean, we've seen for 2 years now their system has produced amazing results. The playoffs last year, a lot of people point to being a flaw for them. But I still say to that, they were really injured in the postseason last year, and that wasn't really a true indication of what they are at this point. Why do you think everyone hates the Celtics so much? I mean, a lot of people have ripped Al Horford. It just seems like a strange guy to rip for me. People still seem to look at Isaiah Thomas with such skepticism. I mean, they're not really the most polarizing team. Why do you think people have such a thing against them?
I don't think people are out to get the Celtics. Like, I don't think there's some sort. They're not out to get them. Boston is one of those teams with loud, passionate fans who have been spoiled in the grand scheme for a franchise, and they've seen a lot of winning. You know what I mean? This is a franchise with a proud history. They've got a strong fan base, and they're good again. So, I mean, it's a vocal fan base, and you know how social media goes. When people are winning, you're either with them or against them, and that's true in every sport. So I think you get a lot of that. But when it gets to Isaiah Thomas, I mean, you look at the advanced numbers and the whole, you know, on-off numbers are confusing and frustrating at times. And I'm sure it's super frustrating as a Boston fan watching Isaiah Thomas. You know, you're watching those games and watching him just save you in the fourth quarter and then having skeptics be like, yeah, well, their defense sucks with him on, and really he's not that good because he gives up just as much as he gets. And, I mean, it's complicated. But the problem is we have, as fans now, we have such a range from, hey, I kind of watch the game at the bar once a while, or I kind of watch the game like when I look up from my phone and stop tweeting once a while, to, hey, I'm going over every play of every game with a fine comb. So it's never a level playing field for these debates. Yeah. And I think guys like Al Horford and Isaiah Thomas and Avery Bradley, Marcus Smart, there's a lot of guys there who, if you're just looking at one number, or you're just looking at one game, you can jump to a lot of conclusions with those guys. Like Al Horford's soft, or Marcus Smart's a nut job, or Isaiah Thomas is the worst defender in the world. And maybe in that moment, that feeling is justified, but there's just a lot of context with a lot of the Boston players that I don't think the average fan really wants to or cares to delve into.
If they're healthy in the playoffs, do you see them getting to the Eastern Conference Finals and pushing the Cavs?
I think it depends how things shake out. I don't fall into this group that's against the Celtics, but I still see them as the fourth best team on paper right now in the East.
Behind Toronto and Cleveland and Washington?
Yeah, I would probably pick, health. We have to see what Lowry looks like and health permitting, but I still think they're the fourth team there. Things have got to come together. I don't know if the defense is there. I don't know if the rebounding is there. We've seen. I don't think Cleveland has this magic switch. We keep getting stuck on this magic switch and Tyronn Lue's secret plan and all these stupid hypotheticals. But
the secret plan, that one kills me.
And it is. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's, hey, I don't have any answers right now, but let's not make this any more dramatic than it has to be. But at the end of the day, they do have LeBron James. I wouldn't bet against LeBron James.
Mm-hmm. That's the magic switch right there, LeBron. Number eight. Yeah. Speaking of LeBron, superstar. When it comes to LeBron, there's no doubt he's a superstar. But when you move down the ladder of NBA hierarchy, there seems to be a divide about, you know, who we can call a superstar. And it's semantics, but I think it's an interesting conversation because there's a factor that comes into play when we talk about superstars. And it's the off-the-court thing, you know, the endorsements, the stardom, the celebrity status these guys have. When it comes to you and your own criteria of who's a superstar, what's most important to you? And what comes into play when you consider whether or not a guy is a superstar?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, this is like, again, obviously you're a mega fan. Obviously I'm a mega fan. We love this sport. So we put a lot more thought into this than the average guy.
Yeah.
And I mean, I heard this year, I've heard Harrison Barnes is a superstar. This year, I've heard CJ McCollum is a superstar. I mean, people always want to just throw X player on their team who's having a good year into that conversation. But in my opinion, to be a superstar, you have to be someone who can get your team to the playoffs with a subpar cast around you. So you don't have to be able to win a title because nobody wins a title by themselves. But you have to know that if, you know, your second best player leaves and it's not a great team, this guy's still carrying the corpse of your franchise to at least a 7-8 seed. And that's probably my really weak but first I don't know, a loud try at what a superstar would be to me.
So would you call Isaiah Thomas a superstar?
In the context of the season, I would. Not to say that Boston has a bad supporting cast. I think Boston has a very good supporting cast. I don't think Isaiah Thomas is a good defender, and I do think he hurts you on defense. And I do think he has some flaws, but he kind of reminds me of Dirk earlier in his career, where your role is very clear. Go out there and put the ball in the hoop. We're going to cover you for you on defense. Marcus Smart blows up screens better than anybody else in the league. Avery Bradley's a plus defender. I mean, it works for them. And people always dog guys for being in the system, but Isaiah Thomas is performing to the absolute maximum amount of his capabilities in the system he's been put, and I won't knock him for that, because that offense, that team, the offense struggles without him, and I mean, he has done everything. It's not like he's early Allen Iverson, or it's not like he's even Russell Westbrook. I mean, he's scoring at a really efficient rate, so I'm not going to penalize a guy for going out and doing what he's supposed to do.
Number nine, the Hall of Fame. There was an interesting conversation this week about, you know, who's the biggest lock to get in the Hall of Fame, and you know, going down the list, some guys like Wade, Dirk, those kind of guys, clear locks to get into the Hall of Fame one day. But, you know, there's these guys that are borderline and still trying to build their case as their careers go on now. I think the guy who was an interesting conversation a few years ago, 3-4 years ago, was Steph Curry, what trajectory he'd be on in that department. Now I think he's become a slam dunk. So who's that next guy for you that you look at and say, can that guy get into the Hall of Fame? And it's borderline right now, but if he does a little more work, he's going to be the slam dunk, just like Steph Curry is right now.
That's a good one. I think the Hall of Fame is kind of a joke. Like, I feel like pretty much everybody gets in. I think the answer to your question for most people would be like Kawhi Leonard or James Harden or Russell Westbrook, but those guys are all locks to me already. Like, I think they're all getting there. Maybe someone like Anthony Davis. Like, if Anthony Davis is definitely got the talent, but he needs to stay healthy, and his team actually has to do something in the playoffs for him to kind of cement that. So I guess maybe he would be my pick.
Maybe DeMarcus Cousins.
Yeah, he maybe in the same breath, but like an even more extreme of, we really need to see like something, anything in terms of wins that matter.
Number 10, wrapping this off, I thought this was a good one. Who do you think is the most underappreciated player in the NBA?
Ooh, that's actually... Oh, man, the most underappreciated player in the NBA. It's never who NBA Twitter tells you it is. NBA Twitter probably still thinks it's Mike Conley. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves Mike Conley.
Before he got the biggest contract ever.
Yeah. But Mike Conley's been beloved by hoop heads for like 3 or 4 years now. It's not like he gets something. You know who someone I think doesn't get any credit is? Hassan Whiteside. I think people just crap on Hassan Whiteside because he was a bit of a knucklehead when he came into the league, and he opened his mouth, and he played in some shadows of some greater players like Wade. But I think he's been really good. I don't think he's a guy that should get dogged. He goes out, he does his job. People want to talk about how rim protection is so important, and then they just snuff away every Hassan Whiteside stat anyone ever throws there. It's not, you know, being an NBA player, you get labeled really quickly, and I think people said Hassan Whiteside was overrated from the tip, and that's kind of stuck. But I think he's been a solid player. I'm not making a case for him to be a superstar, but I don't think he gets his fair due a lot of the time.
I think this question fluctuates a lot because the conversation's always moving. Things develop even in social media really quickly. I think Avery Bradley would have been an interesting case not too long ago, but like you said with the hoop heads, they bring those guys out into the limelight really quickly. I think right now at this very moment, the guy who I think is, you know, really coming into the limelight quickly but still a little underappreciated is Chris Middleton. He is a stud.
Yeah,
I mean, he has the height to play two positions out there on the wing. He's a brilliant shooter. He makes plays for himself. I mean, he's every bit as important to that Milwaukee team as Giannis, as Jabari Parker. I mean, they have a legit big three out there, and they're a scary team once that all comes together.
Yeah, like I wouldn't say he's as valuable as Giannis. I mean, Giannis has scary high potential, but I think he's more valuable than Jabari Parker, and I don't think we would be saying his name if he'd been healthy all year, but that injury really set both him and the Bucks back.
Another guy who I think is coming up quickly and, you know, should be in the most improved player race is James Johnson as well. I've really enjoyed the year he's had down there in Miami.
Yeah, that's annoying for Canadians. Not that anybody really saw what he was going to be as this small ball big and the contributions that he's had. And I mean, I think he's in the running for sixth man of the year too, to a lesser extent, but yeah. But he's been a really good player in Miami, but there was a lot of clamor for him to get more minutes in Toronto and it just never happened. And there's a lot of fans who were picketing for JJ to get some more minutes, but yeah, it did not happen.
So there's 10 questions with Josh Eberle. We're going to get into his story of going from aspiration to accomplishment like we do here on the Bobcast on the other side. First, I'm going to tell you about MyBookie. Great opportunity for you to put some money on the line, add a little more thrill to your sports experience. March Madness is wrapping up, but the hockey playoffs are coming. The NBA playoffs are coming. And MyBookie, there's a lot of sites you can use out there to gamble, but they have a special deal that makes them more appealing than anyone else beyond the fact that they pay on time. All the returns you need, they're going to get right to you in a timely manner. But what's going to make them very appealing right now is join now and MyBookie will match your first deposit with a 50% bonus just for the Bobcast listeners. That's right. If you join with $100, you'll get an extra $50 in your bankroll to play with. Just use the promo code Bobcast, B-O-B-C-A-S-T, to activate your offer. Visit MyBookie today or call 844-900-BETS. 844-900-BETS or mybookie.ag. Play, win, and get paid with MyBookie. On the other side, we're going to talk to Josh Eberle about his journey in writing, NBA, Hoopland, all that. Very interesting story to tell. We'll be right back on the Bobcast.
Hi, this is Larry H. Russell with a message on behalf of the network. As the leading online provider of audio-video coverage of the Boston Celtics, CLNS Radio delivers fans the most provocative discussion and analysis from the most noted personalities in the Celtics realm of the World Wide Web. Home to the number one rated weekly podcast, which covers the NBA's winningest franchise, Celtics Beat is released first thing every Sunday morning. We deliver the hottest of takes and get the lowdown on all things Celtics from players, league executives, and the biggest names in the national basketball media. And it doesn't end there. The original Celtics podcasters John Duke and Justin Poulin have returned. Available Mondays on clnsradio.com. Celtics Stuff Live is back and better than ever before with featured guests that are the most familiar voices to Celtics Nation. Basketball in Boston is heating up and you don't want to miss any of this. Download the CLNS Radio mobile app now. Available for your iPhone and Android.
Welcome back here on the Bobcast, the weekly tour of sports and pop culture, episode 23. Our guest today is a lead writer for Hoop Magazine, a regularly released magazine under the NBA. He also works in communications in the Canadian government and is one of the strongest social media presences in the NBA land. We have Josh Eberle on the program today. And Josh, right off the bat, getting into basketball in Canada, I know basketball is a big thing in Canada now, and it, you know, it's not even worth discussing anymore, but you know, back in the day, hockey is everything in Canada. It still is. So how did a guy like you become such a hoop head living, you know, in the heart of Canada up there in Alberta?
Yeah, I mean, hockey is still king, and it's as much as basketball is like 100 times more popular than it was 10, 15 years ago, I mean, it's still a distant third behind hockey and football and even lacrosse in a lot of places, but baseball. But yeah, I mean, basketball for me was always fun. And I mean, I guess elementary was probably when I started playing, but the big reason that I was basketball and not a hockey kid, and I don't really know, I played shitty when I was younger, but my parents didn't have a lot of money when I was a little kid, and hockey's expensive. Like, you got to get new pads every year because you're growing, and costs a lot to get all these new pads and skates. And I mean, basketball, give your kid a shirt and shorts and let him go shoot, and it just took. Like, I just loved basketball from a very, very young age. I mean, I never really got in when we were growing up and my friends were playing video games and stuff. I mean, I was like 12, 13, I wanted to come home and watch a game. My friends would want to go play like Call of Duty or Halo or whatever it was. It was just always a passion for me, and it started there.
So when you were growing up, was that, I mean, were the Raptors around at that point? Was that the Vince Carter era? I mean, what were the Raptors like at that point? And in a larger context, how important do you think the Raptors as a whole have been, you know, back then and now to the popularity of basketball in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, when I started coming into it, Vince Carter nurtured my relationship with basketball. Like, I absolutely love Vince Carter. It's hard to even explain, like, how important he was to basketball in Canada and to, like, a kid like me who – you would roll the highlights, like the half-hour highlight show, whatever you watch in Boston or wherever. Mm-hmm. And in Calgary, when we had two stations, we had SportsCenter, we had TSN, and 29 minutes would be hockey highlights, like 29 minutes of the show. And that last minute, you would get a Vince Carter dunk maybe, maybe like a CFL highlight, and maybe like a tennis highlight, and it all crammed in that last minute, and that was it, right? So, I mean, Vince Carter was the reason that the Raptors started to get any coverage outside of actually Toronto. Because, I mean, Canada's huge. Like, people, I'm sure you know, but a lot of people, Americans, are like, Toronto is so far from where I am in Calgary, mm-hmm. and it just was not a factor until Vince Carter was slamming down that basketball with just ferocity. I mean, he really, really, I've never disliked Vince. Everything that happened, I was always like, I don't even care if it's the worst case scenario and he hates ownership and he hates Canada. I just appreciate that he got basketball on my television in the morning before I went to school. I got to see a dunk. Like, it was just awesome to have that. The Raptors getting good helped, but to be honest, the Raptors have always had really crappy, shitty marketing. I mean, until We the North, they did such a terrible, terrible job of cultivating a fan base in Canada other than the surrounding area in Toronto. I mean, it's brutal. You have this country of, you know, almost 40 million people, and they have one team. They have one team that they can call their own. Mm-hmm. And there was just no effort made when I was younger to, let's get a couple Raptors out there in the summer to run camps, or, you know, let's do some marketing in Western Canada. Like, it just didn't happen. We the North really the rise of the DeRozan-Lowry teams and the We the North really did a lot for promoting the team. But until that time, it was really they did a really bad job of reaching anyone outside of Ontario.
So you're a University of Calgary grad. You've had a couple different internships, you know, during your school times, working with magazines, working with basketball outlets, stuff like that. Making your way through those different opportunities. Did you know from the very beginning you always wanted to be a basketball writer? And what was a very impactful moment for you, whether it was in college or with those internships and stuff like that, that you felt you were really brought to the next level as a writer?
So right out of high school, I went into J school. I was doing an internship my second year at a local paper just outside of Calgary. So it was like a weekly paper. And my first assignment was on a women's group who knitted for charity. And I went there like thinking, you know, I just want to write sports, you know. Yeah. I just want to do basketball. And I remember it was around March Madness. I don't know when this would have been, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And they're like, okay, Josh, like, You paid your dues. You've been here a month. You wrote all the fluff. Write us something on March Madness. Like, I hadn't even got to write anything on the NBA for them yet. So I'm so excited. You know, I get home. I'm going through all these previews. I'm listening to stuff. I'm looking at the lines. I'm writing all this stuff down. I get like a 1,000-word column, right? I get it all written down. They didn't give me a cap, right? So I thought there was freedom. They end up chopping my story to like 75 words, sticking in the top right corner of like page 6 in the sports section. And it was just kind of like a wake-up call for me that was like, you have to. Print is dead. There is not a desire. Well, print is dead. It was dying. Yeah. And there's no desire for basketball talk in our daily magazines here in Canada. So you really, for me, that was stop trying to go this route and start expanding, start networking and branch out. And that's really the time that I actually started getting on Twitter, started going to LinkedIn, started going to conferences, meeting, expanding kind of what I thought I was going to, where I thought I was going to end up writing and trying to find other venues.
You have a massive Twitter following. I mean, you're one of the leading basketball conversation pushers out there on Twitter. That's why I'm a big fan of following your account, just always being involved in the conversation out there. When did Twitter become a big thing for you in your journey toward writing for basketball. And compared to some of the other things in the past where we've had online conversations, I think it's interesting. I mean, Twitter just feels like such a constant presence at this point, but there were other things like it in the past before this. Like you said, people used to talk in forums and the bars and all that different kind of stuff. The forum of basketball talk has always been changing, and even though it feels like Twitter might be here forever, there might be something else that everyone moves to in the future. So when did Twitter become a big deal for you, and how long do you see it becoming the land for basketball heads?
Yeah, you know, I get scared. I hear I have sunk an awful lot of time into Twitter, and I don't say that like a chore. I absolutely love the app. I love talking basketball with people. And before Twitter, I was on Pro Sports Daily, and I had like 40,000 posts on there. But I actually never really wanted to get into Twitter. I thought it was dumb. But when I was going through J school, they were like, "This is going to be big. Like you gotta get into this." And people are sharing their stories. So I got into it just to like link dump initially, and I had like 120 followers of local people, and I just kind of started to see it more as a vehicle, and instead of trying to. I mean, everyone does dump their stuff. It's part of the game, but it's, but as you said, making those conversations and having fun with it, and forget the forum because it takes longer. You have to sort through. Like, let's just let's tweet. Let's get to the meat of the issue. You can't say it in 140 characters. Say it somewhere else, or you have to earn my click. And I just think there's a lot of beautiful things about Twitter. I do get scared when I see Twitter stock prices, you know, whatever. And I'm not a great. You know, I don't know the stock market and the business market, but I've heard Twitter's in trouble, and I think to myself, I don't know what the next thing is. You know, whether it's, you know, I fool around with Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, bumpers. I do all that stuff because I think it's part of this game now. But I do really think Twitter is something special to the NBA community on a whole, and I do really enjoy the time there.
It is crazy to think that, like, we as basketball people, I mean, we are on there all the time, every single day. It feels like the whole world's on there all the time. And then you hear that Twitter's fan, like, it just doesn't register in your head, right? That, you know, everyone uses this, but at the same time, they're not making any money. It's crazy to think about.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I think that that points to some bad management up top with the amount of users and the amount of engagement that they have on that website that they can't turn a profit. But, hey, what do I know?
So Hoop Magazine's where you're working now. You're also doing some communications work for the government in Canada. When did you land that Hoop Magazine job, and what has that been like for you? What kind of opportunities has that given you? How much have you enjoyed working for that job? I mean, you're working right under the NBA, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a major blessing. I'll just say that. Like, I owe a lot of thanks to Ming Wong, who brought me on. He's my main editor there, and you know, being a kid from Canada who knew I didn't know a single damn person who did anything with the NBA, like not even basketball. I didn't know a single person who wrote about basketball, talked about basketball, made a living in regards to basketball. So every connection that I've ever made, I think is hard earned. And you know, I graduated from journalism, then I graduated from communications, and I landed a 9-to-5 here in Alberta, and I was lucky to get that job in a recession right when I graduated. And, you know, at the same time, I wanted to pursue writing and keep doing that because I've been freelancing for a while and working for smaller blogs, et cetera, and cutting my teeth. And, I just started reaching out. I reached out to a number of people that I'd had conversations with, whether it was face-to-face or just, you know, via Twitter or just via LinkedIn or just via Facebook. And, you know, you do. I mean, for whatever – it's hard to sell to the older generations, but you make relationships on this app, and you're on there enough, I'm sure you know.
Yeah,
but
of course.
You start to get to know people, and it's beyond, and it's not just, you know, who's better, Kobe or LeBron, but like you start to private message people, and you know, you're connected on multiple platforms, and you see what they're doing in their life. And
genuine, it really does, and it is genuine to a large degree, you know, the conversations you have on there and the way you develop relationships with people.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's definitely people who are just in this for themselves, and there's definitely people who, you know, just want to mess around and troll you. But there's a lot of people who are just trying to get to similar places and or were where you are now. And I think there's a lot of understanding that can be reached upon. And anyways, I just started reaching out, say, hey, you know, I'm a graduate of journalism and communication. I've worked at X, Y, and Z. If you need anyone to help freelancing, I'm your guy. And, you know, Ming said, write me a piece and we'll see what happens. And I did. And he said, okay, write me another one. We'll see what happens. And I did. And this went on for 5-6 pieces. And then he says, okay, you can hop on the online site. Let's set up a one piece per week kind of contract kind of thing. And I was through the roof excited. And then I got to actually make my debut in the actual print magazine this year. And I mean, yeah, it's been an absolute blast and I'm very, very grateful.
What are your future aspirations in working around basketball? What's your big vision for yourself working in the media one day? And what do you ultimately want to accomplish in your career?
Yeah, that's the big question. Yeah. And I'm very much I don't think I'm right on the ledge right now, but I'm creeping up to that ledge where if you want to make it full time, you're going to have to jump. And for some people, that jump isn't as big. I mean, they already live in an NBA market, and it just requires they quit their day job, write full time, and show up to all the games and the practice and stuff, or you know, whatever it is. But for me, living in Calgary, nowhere near an NBA market, my jump is going to have to be like move yourself across the country or to a new country and take a pay cut and bust your hump and try to make it. And I hope that there's an opportunity to do that. But I'm fortunate in that I have a 9-to-5 now that I don't hate.
Yeah.
And basketball is my part-time gig, and I would love for it to be my one day full-time gig. But I'm fortunate in that I'm waiting to see if the right opportunity comes across instead of just jumping at the first one. I think. That's where I'm at.
That's something I think a lot about too as well, going full-fledged in that direction, how difficult it is. Another thing I think about as well, and I want to hear your thoughts on it, is there's so many people trying to push, you know, whether it's writing basketball or just writing sports in general and trying to become like a big personality online or a big success in the journalism field. And there's a lot of people producing content online. It's just so easy to do now. Anyone who's online can produce content. So from your perspective, what do you think makes you unique? And what do you try to do that makes you unique and stand out from the crowd? Because it's obvious that you do stand out from the crowd. You've got a strong following. You've done a great job. What do you think it is that makes you stand out among all those people on the internet?
Well, firstly, I appreciate that. And second, I just think, not that other people don't work hard, but I do take pride in the fact that I knew nobody and I had to work hard just to get any recognition. And you do start with zero followers and you do start with zero job prospects and you do start writing blog posts for free for whatever, you know, little site that, I started working on like little blogs that probably had 8 readers a month, like, you know, just putting up hackery back in the day, and you plug away and you look for your opportunities. And I think that I'm a good networker. Good networker, and I work hard, and I know that, you know, nothing is given, and I don't take that for granted. And I think, you know, I'm not the smartest guy, I'm not the best with analytics, but I'm an open-minded guy, and I try to learn and constantly advance myself and verse myself in the topic that I'm interested in, which is basketball, whether that's reading a book or reading an article. Like, I read more than I write. And finally, I just think I'm a natural conversationalist. Like, I think that's part of why my social media has done well, because I enjoy starting conversations and taking them where they go.
Last question I got for you today before we let you get off to your dinner. We've had a good time with Josh Eberle today. Last thing I want to pull from your career so far, what do you feel the coolest moment you've had working in media has been so far, whether it's in your own work or just witnessing an event or anything like that?
Coolest thing so far. This is going to sound super lame. you'd think I'd have a better story than this, but the coolest thing that has happened to me in this industry is just starting to hear yes instead of no. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, like, I live in Calgary, but so I can't go to the games very often or whatever, but I have been told that I can get a credential for All-Star Weekend in LA next year. I can get a credential for the finals. I'm not sure how much of that's on my dime, how much is it on the company dime, but yeah, it's really cool going from a kid who just wanted to be part of this, even have the smallest presence in this like awesome basketball world, to going to, you know, an adult and having people say, yeah, you know, yeah, we can do that for you. What days are you here? When do you need your pass? And I mean, I think that's really cool.
Well, if you're going to the finals this year, get ready to watch Boston.
We'll have to do a special version of the Bobcast if I'm in Boston this year.
Oh, no doubt about it. And I'll be back in Boston as well from Syracuse at that point. Some people think it's crazy. I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility, and that's why I say it. I'm not a troll. I only say things I believe. So thank you for being with us today, Josh. I had a lot of fun talking to you. And if you want to follow Josh, at Josh Eberle, that's where you can find him on Twitter. Hoop Magazine, where you can find his work. And hopefully we'll hear from you again soon, Josh.
Thank you very much for having me on. It was a blast.
That's Josh Eberle, and this has been episode 23 of the Bobcast. As always, our wonderful sponsor on the Bobcast is Blue Apron, a company you can trust to get you fresh ingredients and recipes whenever you need them. They have 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States, so you're getting the best ingredients if you're dieting around Blue Apron, the freshest ingredients. And that's what it's all about. And if you live in a family environment, you're going to be able to be in a situation where you come together and cook together every night because it's so easy and it's so affordable. Under $10 per person per meal, which is less than the high-end grocery chains. And they have a variety of meals that fit your needs. 52 weeks in a year, you can get meals tailor-made to be as diverse as you want. Fit your vegan diet, fit your gluten-free diet. And that's what's awesome about Blue Apron is they make it easy for you as long as you invest in them. And I definitely recommend it from my experience. I have had countless great meals working alongside Blue Apron at this point. One of my favorites is salmon, my favorite food, and they do it very well. So you're going to get a very special deal with Blue Apron as long as you go through the Bobcast, and I'm going to share this secret with you right now. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free, completely free. That's with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/Bobcast. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/Bobcast. Thanks to Josh Eberle for being with us today. Thank you for following me at Real Bob Manning, at Bobby Manning. And thanks for continuing to support the Bobcast. Like I said, the number one thing you can do for our show is find us on iTunes, give us that subscribe, rate us 5 stars. That's all I'll ever ask for you as the head of the Bobcast. And thanks for making this experience so good. Anybody who listens, I really appreciate you. And stay tuned. Our next episode is going to be Snotty Drippin making his return to the Bobcast. Always a fun guy to talk to. And as the playoffs approach, continue to follow along with me. I'll be continuing to produce content for Celtics Blog, continuing to try to find my way over here at Syracuse University. Thanks to everybody for their input on this show. And we will see you next week. Peace.